I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last year, I attended a conference at the Council on Foreign Relations, and I've brought it up a few times because it was a wonderful couple of days where I met so many great people, and a few of them have become guests, and I am still dipping into that well. Last year, at the conference, I met Ani Zondeveld. She is the director of Muslims for Progressive Values. And it was a fascinating experience for me to see her interact with people of variety of religions, academicians, and also Muslims outside of the fold of progressive Muslims. And from that point, I've always wanted to have a conversation with her, and she has graciously assented. Let me tell you a little bit about Ani. She is a Malaysian-American. She's a singer-songwriter, activist, and a writer based in Los Angeles. She has released full albums on her own, including Ummah Wake Up, One Islamic Hymns Celebration of Life, produced for other artists, and participated in the writing of Grammy-winning songs. She is the first Malaysian to have won a Grammy. She's the president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values, a nonprofit organization in the United States with affiliates in Canada, Europe, Chile, Australia, and Malaysia, creating inclusive communities that welcome and support interfaith marriages, gay marriages, gender and sexual minorities, as well as sectarian minorities. Zondeveld is also the co-editor of Progressive Muslim Identities, Personal Stories from the U.S. and Canada, a 2011 anthology that features a diverse group of progressive Muslims. So we welcome to Common Threads Ani Zondeveld. Hello, Ani.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. My first question goes back to that conference that we attended last year together, and that is I was able to see you, as I mentioned in the introduction, I was able to see you interact with a variety of people, especially during the Q&A when we were listening to panel discussions. And I saw a definite difference in the take that you may have had on any given subject versus the take of some of your Muslim colleagues who would probably be considered moderate Muslims by most, including themselves. I'm guessing that these other people who attended would self-identify as moderate Muslims. And I just saw a tension, if you will. And I realized that you probably do find yourself between two different flanks. For instance, you have to deal with those people who are just Islamophobes altogether, that just think that nothing good can come out of Islam, the politicians that we have here today who claim that it's not even a religion, that it's purely a political ideology. You have that flank, and then you have the so-called moderate Muslims or conservative Muslims who may not think that you're Muslim enough, or perhaps that you're not even Muslim. And I'm curious, what's that like in your life?
I think you were being a little bit generous in describing the confrontation that I had at the Council on Foreign Relations that year. It was actually a little bit more of an attack on me based on the question I had fielded. And it was a panel discussion on education, and my challenge to the panelist, to the Muslim panelist, who is described to be Muslim, otherwise he wouldn't be sitting in the room with us, is, well, what have you actually done in regards to promoting a theology of pluralism, which is really the essence of what the Quran teaches? And he never answered that question. That was the problem. And when I challenged him on the issue of the intolerance in the Muslim world, that became a challenge to his authority. And so you could see the tension. It wasn't just the tension. It was, if you recall, it was a direct assault on my line of questioning. And as far as being stuck between the Islamophobes of the anti-Islam camp and the so-called moderate and conservative, it's challenging. But the fact is, the reason that Muslims for Progressive Values is still standing now in our 10th year, and that we have not only can still consist of members here in the United States and beyond, but we are continuing to grow. And that is because our values really resonate, number one. And number two, that those religious orthodox Muslims, moderate or conservative, what have you, cannot debase the basis of our work, because our work is rooted in the Quran, is rooted in some of the more pluralistic interpretation of Islam, the more egalitarian, the more inclusive and loving, compassionate interpretations of Islam. This is nothing new. This is not a quote-unquote American Islam. This is rooted in our theology. The problem is, in the last 25 years, the beautiful version of Islam have become so bastardized that it is unrecognizable. You know, I'm old enough to say that I knew an Islam that was so much more beautiful than the current state that it is. So our challenge to the status quo is, hang on a second, that practice of Islam, that belief system, for example, you know, this tendency now to believe that women was created from the rib of Adam, Eve was created from the rib of Adam. That's not Islam, actually. That is actually Christianity. The fact that many Muslims now are starting to not believe in evolution, that is such an alien concept to me and to many of the older Muslims, because that's not how we always believe Islam to be. We've always believed in science. We've always believed in rational thinking. So all of this goes... you know, all this goes against the grain of what is the dominant narrative, and I don't say that it is the mainstream, because it's not mainstream. Because American Muslims are inherently progressive. That's why only 22% of American Muslims actually attend mosque. The majority of Muslims who identify themselves as Muslim don't attend mosque. So those are the numbers. Anyway, that's the other thing aspect of being stuck in between the anti-Islam and the moderate, so-called moderate, is that the theology from which we base our work and our advocacy undermines a lot of the rationale for the anti-Islam camp. What they do is they just basically cut and paste, particularly hadith, from the conservative and radical Muslim camps, and they cut and paste it to justify their prejudices. And when we come back with a Quran passage that contradicts their hadith, it really unravels their hate. And actually, what it does is it really makes it even more dangerous for us, because it debases their hatred and they go berserk. And it's a real concern for us. It's a real safety concern for us.
I'm sure. Could it possibly be that one of the reasons you're saying that the Islam that you're seeing right now isn't the Islam you remember is because you grew up in Malaysia?
No. I was born in Malaysia, but I didn't grow up there. But the Islam of Malaysia was inclusive. It was, you know, more Sufi in its spirit, easygoing. It wasn't rigid. But that's not just in Malaysia, Malaysia's unique too, because we have Hindus, we have Christians, we have Buddhists, and it's multicultural and multi-religious society. But even Malaysia now has become really like Saudi Arabia. We have the moral police. It's just gone backwards in that regard. But even when I lived in Egypt, you know, Muslims have always been poor and oppressed by the political elite. Let's take Egypt, for example. When I lived there, 1969 to 1974, they were poor, they were oppressed. But they were not radical. They were not intolerant and hateful. And the only difference between what was then and now is the theology of hate. You know, I'd walk into a poor neighborhood in Egypt, and a man sitting on the ground with his family with one piece of bread, you know, and he would tear a piece of it and offer it to me. That is the Islam I know.
But it is
generosity. Yeah.
So, forgive me, I was mistaken. I thought you spent more time in Malaysia. No, you left as a child?
My dad was an ambassador, Malaysian ambassador to Germany, Egypt, and India. So for a good 16 and a half years, I lived abroad.
I see. Okay. And do you think that one of the reasons that Malaysia, in the older days, I understand that right now it's going through a lot of challenges that other Muslim-majority countries are, but you mentioned that other influence, the Hindu influence, the Christian influence. Do you think that more the pluralistic societies, the societies that have a multitude of religions, actually influence all of them to the positive? You know what I'm saying? When you have a lot of religions.
Yeah. No, I think, well, to start out with, I can speak about Malaysia. To start out with, you know, we are pluralistic, and it wasn't an issue for the most part. I wouldn't say perfectly so, but you know, when I was four or five years old, you know, a little aware of my environment, I would ask my mom, how can we pray like this and other people pray differently? And my mother would say, well, we all pray to the same God in our own different ways. And that was her response. But that is not the response you get now. And as a matter of fact, there are camps in Malaysia that, you know, they're very loud and very vile, basically claiming that as Muslims we are not allowed to greet our non-Muslim citizens, greet them Merry Christmas or Happy Easter or Happy Deepavali or whatever, Happy Wasak Day, you know, whatever that is non-Muslim, we're not allowed to because it is a betrayal to Islam, which is nonsense. And I think the dynamics of the Muslims in Malaysia, which are the majority, has always been inclusive in nature, and so therefore it wasn't an issue. And therefore, in Malaysia, you will have the, you know, temples, churches, mosques, all in the same street, and it's not an issue. But it has become an issue now where it's very difficult for non-Muslim faith traditions to build their religious places of worship.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today is Ani Zonneveld. She is the president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values. Now, one of the reasons I believe that you get a little flack from the more conservative Muslims and so-called moderate Muslims is that you have no problem talking about the flaws that you see in the religion as it is practiced. And haven't you been accused of sort of being a traitor or giving ammunition to true Islamophobes?
Well, yes and no, but the thing is, we don't give the ammunition. It's they that give the moderate conservative Muslims that give the ammunition. Because when we defend Islam, we defend it from the context of the Quran. And how are you going to argue against that? That's a sacred text, so I'm not making it up. The fact is, the flack that we get from the more conservative entities of our community is the fact that we are challenging their power base. We're challenging the way they practice. We're challenging their belief system, and it's difficult for them to actually negate what we challenge. The only way to move forward is to be honest, right? Whether you're Muslim or not, I'm honest about the issues in the Muslim community and the practices from which we are basing our theology. But at the end of the day, we make a full circle by saying, you know what? Let's take, for example, this issue of women leading prayer. We are a strong advocate of women leading a code congregation in prayer. I lead prayer. And we always empower our lay leaders, please step up. Take ownership of the spiritual leadership. Lead prayer. The religious authorities have a problem with that, obviously. So their argument is, well, women have never led code congregation in prayer. They use hadith, which is a secondary text that was written and compiled 200 years after Prophet Muhammad died, claiming that men praying behind women is, their prayer will not be accepted by God. You know, all these convoluted explanations. But the truth of the matter is we've always had women leaders, teachers. The first converts to Islam were women. They were the ones that taught men. They led prayer, covered congregation in prayer. And in the Quran, it's very clear. There's no gender requirement for being a religious leader. It's only those who are most qualified and chosen by the community members. So that is what the Quran says. And so when the conservative entities argue on us, they're arguing on a very weak theological justification. And that is a problem for them. It debases their authority. And that is where the crux of the argument lies.
I understand that in the greater Muslim community there is argument as to which hadith are absolutely correct and historically factual, and what might have been made up to satisfy somebody's ego or agenda. Do you use hadith at all? Are there hadith that you can say, this sounds like it is appropriate for our use?
Yes. We have a benchmark, and the rule of thumb is basically, if the hadith does not contradict the Quran, then we will use it. If it does, we throw it out. So let's take again the women-led prayer hadith. It was proven, it was written that Umm Waraka was the first female imam appointed by Prophet Muhammad himself. But that's not what we were taught. We were never taught that particular hadith, but we were taught all of these incredibly misogynistic hadiths, which actually contradicts the teaching of the Quran. So that's the interesting dynamic, that what we're finding is those that are considered more moderate or conservative, they are actually more believers of the hadith than they are of the Quran. And a lot of the arguments and pushback we get are from justifications of the hadith. And so it's very easy for me to argue back, says, well, hang on a second, that contradicts the Quran, verse so and so. Explain yourself now. Are you a Muslim that, because according to the belief is that Muslims must believe that the Quran is the word of God. So then what are you then? The believer of the Quran or the believer of hadith, which is written by men? That stumps them all at every corner. Let's take another example. The most popular verse that Islam is known for now is the wife-beating verse 434, right? 4:34, chapter 4. The non-Muslims know this verse so well, and we get thrown this. You know, one of the reasons Islam and Muslims are demonized and looked down is the treatment of women. So we uphold the values of women as equal to man, equal to everyone. Everyone's equal. And so when these conservative Muslims and the anti-Islam camp comes to us with verse 434, giving the husband's permission to beat their wife, well, we go back to hadith and say, hang on a second. You believe Prophet Muhammad is the perfect man example that we should follow. Correct, Mr. Muslim? Mr. Mullah? Yes, of course, of course. All right, great. Now, did he beat his wife? No, he never did. What did he do? He actually walked away when he was in a very heated argument with his wife. So the other word, meaning, the translations of this particular word, daraba, one is to beat, and the other one was to walk away. There's like 17 different meanings to this one word. Then why is it that we were taught that the word means to beat? And why were we not then taught that it is to walk away, to separate yourself, which is actually what Prophet Muhammad did? And the conservatives cannot argue with that. And the non-Muslims are stumped. Oh, if that is a true translation, what do we do with this now? How can we, you know, this is actually quite enlightening.
There is
so that's how we make our arguments.
Thank you. There is a new version of the Quran that I know is out. I have not read it. I have sampled a couple of YouTube videos about it, but I certainly can't speak with any authority. The study Quran. One, are you familiar with it? And number two, what is your take on it, if you are?
I'm familiar with it, but I do not have a copy of it myself. It's something that I've been meaning to do. What we use as a reference is the Quran, a reformist translation. A reformist translation. It's by Edip Yüksel. And what's interesting about this interpretation of the Quran is that it uses the language of the Quran itself to translate itself, which makes a lot of sense, because what's been happening throughout the centuries is that people have been using their own understanding, their own Arabic language, post the revelation of the Quran to translate the Quran. And it has a very different meaning and very, obviously, very different cultural context when you do it that way.
And now that's interesting that you say the Quran you use is called the reformist. And I know that a lot of conservative and even moderate Muslims sort of bristle at the idea of reform.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Why the word is almost halal? Not halal, haram.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. The Muslim narrative is that Islam is perfect and does not need reforming. But the problem is Muslims are the ones that need reforming. They need to change their thinking about what Islam is and the practice of Islam. And that is where the Reformation needs to happen. Now, the truth is that throughout the centuries, we've had reforming thinking scholars of Islam and practitioners, progressives, but a lot of them have been silenced and a lot of them have been killed. And in recent histories, they've been either killed or under house arrest. And so, you know, it also bodes a lot of these reforming thinking Muslim scholars of Islam are also a challenge to authority, whether they be Muslims or the colonialists of the day. And so a lot of the critical thinking, it has a lot to do with political power, and we cannot separate the two. Islam has been used as a political tool for centuries, whether they are by Muslim political leaders or by the colonialists. And, religion is powerful. We know that. We know that in our American elections process even. So Islam is no exception in how it has been used as a political tool.
In the progressive Muslim world, is there room for instance, allegory? There's a significant controversy, of course, in the broader Christian community when looking at the Bible. What is allegory? What is absolute guaranteed history? In the Muslim world, is there that same argument, or do people pretty much have to say, no, this is history and allegory doesn't exist, or mythology doesn't exist?
Methodology as in jurisprudence or in...
No, just in studying the history of the Quran, in studying the history of the life of the Prophet and all of this. Can certain stories be taken as allegory or mythology, or is there a general consensus? No, if you're a Muslim, you believe that these things are history.
It's both, right? So there are segments of the Quran where, let's take the obvious one, where it talks about killing the non-believers. This is actually, that is an absolute, but in that historical context only, and only then. And that was during the time when Prophet Muhammad and his small committee was under assault. I mean, they were, in modern day times, you know, they were always under attack violently. There was always a assassination attempt. And so therefore they had to build alliances with trusted allies. And that happened, and so this is the political gamesmanship, right? So in order to survive, you have to negotiate your space. The first safe space for Prophet Muhammad and his community was by a Christian king. And until today, there is that agreement between Prophet Muhammad and Christians of that time, which is supposed to be through the end of time, is the safety of Christianity, that their places of worship will never be destroyed and that they will never be under attack. Christians will always be protected under Muslim rule. And obviously, this is not what we see in the current day and age. And that's the bastardization of Islam that we're seeing today. So to go back to the Quran and you know, what can be seen as a methodology, or it depends on the time of the revelation, because there was the spiritual time and there was the political time from which the revelation from which the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad. So when it came down to the time of war, when they were really under assault, it was absolutely for that particular time, and that cannot be taken to slaughtering those of Christian and Jewish and non-Muslims, as we have seen practiced by ISIS today.
Ani, we are down to the wire this week, but this is a fascinating conversation, and I hope you'll join us again next week.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today, Ani Zadeveld, and she is the president and founder of Muslims for Progressive Values. Please join us again next week here on WGVU.